RF modulated. So you can, for instance, come off an antenna like I do, or you can come out a cable. You could take a cable and hook that up to the input of that as well. You know, remember we're on either channel 3 or 4. It's still got the switch on there. You tie that output directly into your RF TV, whichever type of TV you have. If it's only got RF, you put it in, and you should be good to go. You know, and then not the composite ones. Composite ones are the red, blue, and green. I still use them, by the way. I have them hooked up to my HDTV instead of the HDMI cable. Anyway, back to you, Ron.
Okay, very good, Paul. The problem, as I see it, is it really depends upon the protocol that the RF converter is designed for. If it's ATSC, 1, 2, or now 3, it probably wouldn't be compatible with enhanced definition. So it sort of depends upon the unknown protocol that they use for that type of signal. These things are specific to their type. An NTSC RF device is one thing, and ATSC device is another thing. And I don't know exactly where the enhanced display fits into that spectrum, if it does at all.
Oh, okay, well, I have two of them here hooked up to two different video recorders. And one upstairs, one downstairs. It works fine. And then, I also tie it into the antenna for broadcast TV. So if cable goes down, I have a backup. But, I've never had a problem with that. Back to you, Ron.
Okay, but most likely you're feeding it a signal of an ATSC signal from your antenna, right?
Doing actually three things. From the antenna, also from a VCR, which is coming out with the composite cables, no problem. And another one, I also have a switch. I can switch back and forth between the antenna and cable, so I could do three different cable, TV, composite connections to a VCR, or a regular DVD. It doesn't have to even be a VCR. I can play a DVD machine into it as well.
AC2GS. Okay, it works for you. The problem, again, is that, ATSC is ubiquitous. So although you can't get that type of device anymore, probably, because there's very little demand still, whether or not it works nicely with enhanced display is anyone's guess, because it's some flavor of digital, but I don't think it's derived directly from pre-ATSC standards, so we'll find out eventually.
Yeah, maybe you have some screen issues, screen size issues, but not to worry. If you're just playing back all your videotapes, I'm sure it would be fine.
I mean, the one thing that has been mentioned is it's rather surprising if you price modern-day flat panel televisions, unless you want the latest, greatest thing, have plummeted in price. They've become practically commodities. Chinese manufacturers who cut a lot of corners are producing very good quality, second-tier flat panel television sets. So it's not like the bad old days, again, where you could drop a couple of $1,000 necessarily on a TV. Probably for $100, you can get something decent.
Okay. Yeah, it's amazing. I looked at the prices of the OLED TVs a few years ago, and maybe 5 years ago, they were like $7,000 or something. And now they're down to the to a reasonable price. You know, maybe you can get one for under $1,000 now, or even $800.
Yeah, they've been able to expand their manufacturing and cut the losses. Early on, there was a rather high loss percentage, and that's for organic light emitting diodes. And now they have quantum dot organic light emitting diodes that produce higher quality images. And if you want to go inexpensive, LCDs that use quantum dots and regular LED light sources as the background can be had for a pittance with quality that you couldn't reproduce or get any better until maybe about 5-6 years ago. So, again, you don't have to empty the bank if you don't want the latest, greatest, highest resolution with the highest illumination and the highest dynamic range. There's a lot of bargains out there. Well, once again, I continue to be AC2GS, and this continues to be the Limemark Technical Net. We still have a few more minutes. If anyone has any topic or comment to make, feel free. Yeah, sure, Wes.
Yeah, so I just looked at those cameras that are available for the market right now, and all of them, they use the interface that the BNC connector that is not called SD. They add the letter I into it, so it's called SDI. It is unlikely that industry will ever change because there is too much of equipment into it. Also, a number of companies producing the mixers for the cameras. Let's say you have a small church, and the church is calling for a system, audio-video system, so the priest could record everything and eventually post it for the prayers. They use those mixers, and all of those mixers, they have that SD, now SDI, connectors. So that format, what it says in here, gives you a much higher bandwidth. I remember the old time when the Windows were developed, there was a Windows 2000 system, and prior to that was Windows 4 system. It was a very steady platform that never created the problems. I don't know if you ever used that. So that system was compatible with that SDI that was still in use, and it's still in use right now. There is a number of cameras, very expensive cameras, called RED, R-E-D, RED. And those cameras, if you look at them, Google them, they have only or mostly that type of connection. And to actually.
Okay, you're alluding to there was a different kernel. Windows NT. I think the story was that Microsoft was working on one kernel and IBM was working on another kernel, and then they swapped, and one was NT, which was a little bit more bulletproof, and the other one was a little bit simpler and buggier, and NT went on to be Windows Server, and little by little I think they've merged them into kind of one kernel last time I checked. So I recall that. Yeah, it's a different interface. It's a more professional one. I would never say that this is going to be the only connector for the rest of eternity. You never know what technology will bring us. Chances are somewhere down the road it'll be cost effective to swap over to a completely new type of connector that has features that we can't even imagine.
If you remember from the time of Windows NT, NT4, before Windows 2000, there was a network connection that was starting to be developed instead of RJ45 that was using the coaxial cables for the network. Do you remember that? And that was using PNCs.
Well, I remember there were T connectors, and it was sort of a kludge. I was very happy when the RJ45s came in, because they made my life much, much less difficult. But, yeah, I remember there was even a term for that type of Ethernet that IBM offered.
Does it ring the bell, the T1 for the network connection?
Yeah, that was probably it. Like I said, it didn't really give you a lot of choices. It was very problematic. I think back at those times, that was even before there were proper switches. They were more of just generic hubs that were imbeciles that didn't pass through to individual ports. So those were the very early days of networking. But, you know, I always like to try stuff out. So, yeah, I looked into that as well. It deserved its fate. It doesn't really exist other than in museums these days. Oh, 10Base 2. Chris, who's our IT guy, that was the phrase I always heard. 10Base 2. I think T1 and T10 has to do with AT&T's high-speed data network.
Yeah, I remember that time. And from that time, one thing still remains common. There was development of the switches and routers at that time. And I remember I went to the Toro College. They asked me to do something for the system integration. And they were using RJ45 already, so it's a RJ6 cable that was used with it. And they use right now programmable switches with access. And I'm standing in front of the rack in the utility room, which is on every floor in Toro College. And I disconnected the RJ45 from it, and there's like 20 plugs. I didn't think about it, and then I connected back, and I find out that part of the network doesn't work. Oh, gosh. And I called a partner that is more fluent in a network, and then he says, "Gosh, you didn't memorize where the plugs were." I said, "Well, it's a switch." "It's a switch?" "No," he says, "it's a programmable switch." So it took me half of a day to figure out where the plugs supposed to be to make a network working. But fortunately, it was a weekend time, so no students were there and nobody complained. Enter XGN.
AC2GS. Well, you live and you learn. I think they're called moderated switches these days. In the beginning, there was just a generic hub that just sprayed packets all over the place. Then they built a little bit of intelligence, so it figured out which port to switch it to. And now a lot of people, I tried using moderated switches. It didn't really serve any purpose in a personal setting, so I went back to unmoderated switches.
Don't they call them addressable switches?
I'm sure there's a lot of different terms for the same thing. I think when you sell it, managed switch is what Chris says. So that was my understanding, that they allow for an interface and you can set different parameters for different ports. So I think managed switch is the major term for this class of switches.
Yeah, so security actually went up. And we're dealing right now with the situation when privacy is no longer present, and we cannot count on somebody not looking at us or our activity any longer. And we have a number of hacks and the situation where somebody can break into the system, especially when you have 200 cameras in the college system, and they want to prevent just anybody to lurking into the activity on the cameras there. But it's also happened to the classrooms and the computers that are there, and that's where those addressable switches have the application.
Okay, I'm sure there's a hack to get around that. There's a hack for almost everything. I'm sorry, everyone out there. Privacy, if it ever did exist, is a thing of the past. So live your life as though someone is peeping in through your window, because unfortunately, the chances are they might be. I regularly look at my logs for all kinds of things, and there are so many devices on the Internet that just randomly ping everyone else looking for a port that they could use for some nefarious purpose. So, just be mindful and try your best, but live a life that you don't mind being shown in full resolution color.
Oh, by the way, do you have a 4K monitor? Did you change it?
No, I think it failed a while ago because it's more things to break, so I just replaced it with an unmanaged switch, and it works fine with me. I don't have any particular needs to configure ports for specific things like broadcasting packets and such, so keep it simple sometimes is the best approach.
Yeah, I think many people use the communicators like Skype or broadcasting equipment, some of them for YouTube whatsoever. And most of that equipment is right now available, so instead of buying a camera that is dedicated for your computer, you're buying a regular camera. Either the IP camera, which requires the power from IP device that is connected, which would be the IP switch, right, which delivers the power for it, or just separately powered. But the good thing is that those cameras are much higher quality and much less expensive than the average consumer camera that is connected to the computer. And then some of the people wants to have two, three, four cameras they're showing from different angles. And there is a device called ATM. ATM is by Blackmagic. It has eight inputs, so you can connect, let's say, two computers if you have a lecturer, if you are a teacher, or let's say you have something to present over social media or over the communicator like Skype, let's say. Then you can connect regular cameras to it with Zoom, without Zoom, it's up to you, whichever way you want it. And that device converts those cameras to the format where computer at the output thinks that this is the IP camera. So then using the buttons, you can switch between the cameras and the computers, and if you have a material to present, you can actually present it. And that's how live streaming over the YouTube works too. It's very easy, very inexpensive solution. So I have 18 mini extreme ISO. This one is not only allowing the streaming, but it's also giving you the ability to record from cameras, and then if you use Blackmagic DaVinci Resolve, which is free, no pay version, the best editor you could find, or you want to have the studio version, which costs $299, then you can actually take that directly out and you can create your movie then that you can eventually present either to the client or stream it or eventually present it to the YouTube and to XGS.
AC2GS. Yeah, Blackmagic makes a number of ATEM. They're really video switchers. You know, depending upon the number of channels and features, it goes anywhere from $300 to probably a couple of $2,000-$3,000. So, yeah. So when's the next time you're going to make a YouTube? It's been years.
Yeah, there was a time when I was pretty excited with it. So I was making every few days I was making a video, and then I decided that it's a time to break. It was really because I was following a certain time of type of technology, and the technology didn't happen to work as desired, and I was kind of discouraged, unhappy, and decided that not gonna make a videos on it. But yes, I still have the equipment. I'm still thinking that maybe I could switch to some educational videos in area of waveguides, but it is like kind of niche. How do I pronounce it properly? Which not everybody would be interested with. Back to you.
Okay, but I mean, YouTube is very niche, so I don't think anyone would accuse you of too narrow a focus. I saw all your old ones. I was kind of curious when my voice showed up on one of them, but nevertheless, every so often I go and check if there's something new, and there's nothing new. I think one of the last ones featured the statue of Nikola Tesla himself in the background.
Oh, yeah. Well, the story was that I was concentrated on interfaces, which is some sort of waveguide. And although I saw it working in some applications, in my application by other scientists, it didn't work as desired, and that actually made me kind of what's going on. And also there was a guy called Dr. Roy who I admire for who he is and his skepticism, and then I started to think about it. The good thing is you have to have a critics. If you follow a certain direction and you think you are on the right spot or right track, you need critics. And Dr. Roy was actually making an excellent job for it. Enter here.
Well, I agree with you, Wesley. It's no good to have someone just yes you to death. Ask Elon Musk when he's sane. It's always good to be challenged because being challenged requires you to think out the situation in a much better, fuller way, I find, at least. I always like to be challenged.
Yes, but I have acquired a few new pieces of equipment. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely. I've got the signal source, 2 watts, from 50 hertz up to 5 kilohertz. Amazing. American made. The company still exists. I spoke to the owner. He's in New Jersey, and he agreed for me to come over and talk to him. So that is, and also the SWR. SWR from 50 hertz up to 5 kilohertz. Can you believe it? And it's not like a simple meter. No, it's a pretty much beefy device that has its own computer. I mean, they call it because its own computer. It was done on TTLs, if you remember TTLs. But it's absolutely right on the money. And apart from that, the SWR has its own 50 ohm built-in load. So if you want to test, let's say, from one side of the line, let's say there is a coaxial cable, you can connect your signal source, you use that frequency, and then from the other side, you can measure the SWR for it. Bought it for pennies. They also have the receiver that is also working from a 50 hertz up to 5 megahertz, which is on liquid display. I wasn't able to buy it, but I spoke to a manufacturer. They say they still have it. $7,300. I said, I'm sure I'm not going to buy it. I'd rather buy it secondhand. So for anybody dreaming about ham radio at low frequencies, ELF, that's something. Enter XGS.
Okay, very good, Wes. I hope you enjoy the heck out of it, and tell us what you find out from it. It's already 10:27, so I'm going to move on to the SpaceNet report. Wes, if you have any closing comments, please feel free.
I do thank you very much for participation in trying to solve what happened to the I-95 and that tragedy that happened. Probably the driver died during that explosion. They don't say any word about him, and we don't know if there was only one car. There was some notion that there was more than one car there, that there was that truck and probably one or more cars underneath of it. So it is really tragedy. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening and participating in the discussion. And to XGS.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Wes, thanks to everyone for participating tonight. Another fun series of conversations, and hopefully you'll be back next Sunday when we do this all over again. But next up is Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
Okay, thanks, guys. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. And there's a couple of things going. One is that Roy has a, on his website, he's got a bunch of topics, and he's talking about the Arecibo, antenna system possibility that, they're looking into doing something with that. You're not going to get a 1,000-foot diameter antenna put up there anymore, but they're finally looking to do something. It's owned and operated by the Science Foundation, the SFA. Anyway, the that group has finally abandoned the whole project, like the end of the year. End of last year, and apparently now there's a group that would like to do something with it, so they're putting proposals in, and we'll see. Over time, maybe they'll do something with that. Dragon spacecraft, the cargo version, was launched last week and went up to the International Space Station, and it docked to the Zenith port on the Harmony module, front end of the International Space Station. Now, SpaceX has been doing good. I mean, this is the 28th cargo vehicle that has been sent to that space station. Not only that, they're sending crews every 5 months or so. They're launching another crew of four to the space station. Let me drop it. So they occupied one of the ports. The amount of ports on the space station is a total of eight. Some of them are docking ports. Some are combinations of docking and cargo ports. There's two berthing ports. They call them berthing ports. You could attach a vehicle to it, and it's a big wide door. It's 55 inches diameter that you could bring big things through. But most of the docking ports are only about a meter in diameter and enough to get a crew and some supplies through. But NASA put a nice picture up of the International Space Station showing five spacecraft attached to the space station. There's three Soyuz version rockets. Is Progress and two crew vehicles. So there's three of them attached for the Russians. And on the United States European Space Agency side, you have two ports that are now occupied, and both by Dragon crew vehicles. And there's also two more that are not being used, two berthing ports. And they're on the nadir, or Earth-facing side, of both the Harmony module and the Unity module. Now, when I talk about this, it's hard to understand all these different modules. There's like 15 modules that astronauts could be in. So Roy put up the picture on his website of what this configuration looks like, and NASA published a picture, which I copied, and I also added something to it. I added the date, and I added two berthing ports, and I put red marks pointing to where they're located. But it's quite a piece of equipment that's flying around year after year. It's been occupied since year 2000. So 23 straight years for the International Space Station. People have been on board. If you're 22 years old, you don't know a time when there wasn't somebody on the International Space Station. And talking about YouTube, if you go to the LIMOC website and look through the YouTube that they've done, they have a lot of presentations. You find one that has a picture of the International Space Station. That one was done by me, and it's the whole construction, piece by piece, module by module of the space station, but mostly focusing on amateur radio. The locations of the radio board and some of the people that were involved with that. So, you could always go to that. Let me see if there's any comments before I go on.
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay. Yes, well, go ahead, Wesley.
Most of the vehicles delivering crew and supplies to the International Space Station are made by Americans. By Elon Musk, I assume. What is the story with Russians? Are they definitely out? What is the situation? And to achieve?
Got to let the ID go by. Yeah, they make both Progress and crew versions of the Soyuz spacecraft. They look very similar. If you look at both of them, you people don't even be able to tell what the difference is. But they're still making them because they're still sending crews up. Naturally, they're not reusable. So they constantly are making these things. And they're making the cargo version, which is the progress version of the Soyuz. They call it Soyuz, the whole launch vehicle. The rocket itself is Soyuz, and the spacecraft is Soyuz. And so they're still at it. We make, of course, Dragon is being produced by SpaceX, soon to be launched. Hopefully it will be the Starliner being built by Boeing. Another spacecraft, hopefully by the end of the year, things maybe early next year, the Dream Chaser. That one's going to be able to launch on top of a rocket, dock with the space station, and then come back and land on a runway, which will be nice. And that's being done by Sierra Nevada, also an American company. So these are American companies. Naturally, you do have another cargo ship going up on a regular basis called Antares. The rocket, and it's on top of that is the Cygnus spacecraft. That's the cargo version launched, you know, out of Wallops Island, Virginia. And let me drop it. That is partially made in Italy. They make the module and a lot of the interior stuff and electronics. That's all added by Northrop Grumman. It's a combination of the both. So, that's pretty much it, Wesley.
Are we looking at the possible elimination of Russians because they have no resources or they are technically incompatible? What is the future of the International Space Station?
Yeah, well, they're still building rockets. They have the Proton rocket. They still launch Soyuz missions for their military and spy satellites. I mean, they're still at it. But their civilian side, which is Roscosmos, which is similar to NASA, you know, they've been at this for many years. I think 2007 they became Roscosmos. The future, they will still continue to build these. The space end of things and the military end are completely different. So what's going on in the Ukraine, they say, hasn't really affected them. I'm sure it affects them, with some supplies or the things that they need. But they're still, going strong. I mean, there's another launch planned very shortly. They have given up for now. They were designing a new crew spacecraft. They have cut back on that. They were going to build one that would be capable of going to the moon, and I think they've cut back in future stuff. But they're going to keep the present stuff going up until 2030. Because they've agreed with NASA to continue to do that. So I don't see a change. I think the war will eventually end, and this will continue to go on. Don't forget, this all was in the works before Russia, before the Soviet Union was separated. And you had, 20 different entities involved with Russia that have completely been decimated. They're all gone. Now it's just Russia. And that was with the Soviet Union. I mean, we started it in 1974, 1975 with the Soyuz Apollo mission. That was 100% Soviet Union. Big time Cold War. And NASA and Russia have worked together all these decades. Back to you, Wes.
Just one more question. Is it planned for the International Space Station to be a sort of stop between Moon and Earth for the crew trying to go to the Moon, or any kind of role for the International Space Station due to the fact that eventually all activity is going to be on the Moon? And it would be soon, right? 2024, if I'm not mistaken, Andrew Sheen?
Originally, back in the Obama administration, they were thinking 28. Trump got in there, it's 24, you know. And I said back then, there's no way in the world they're going to reverse that and be able to meet those deadlines. Then they pushed it to 2025, and I think it's more like 2026. SpaceX is having a lot of problems with what their responsibility is going to be to actually have a vehicle land on the moon and then come back, you know, with a crew. They're just going to be really running like a shuttle between the moon and a space station that doesn't exist yet, Gateway Space Station. This vehicle, which is going to be like 200 feet tall, is supposed to be launched from Earth, go into Earth orbit, nothing to do with the space station, go into Earth orbit, have another similar starship launch, refuel the one that's up there, maybe with at least two refueling flights. So that's three flights already, and the thing hasn't even gotten to the moon yet. Let me drop it. And Starship will then fly to the moon and stay in orbit around the moon and wait who knows how long. You know, if there's delays, it could be a year or two. And they'll be waiting for the Orion spacecraft to arrive. And then from there, it'll be a crew of four. Two will go into the Starship. The other two will stay on Orion. Starship goes down, lands on the moon. They do whatever they have to do for a week, experiment, pick up rocks, whatever. And the next thing you know, it's a week later, they launch you up the moon in the Starship and go back if there's a Gateway space station around the moon, dock with the Gateway space station. Crew will transfer to Orion, and I take the same four people and fly them back to Earth. Now, to get the Starship to do all this, they launched one, a month and a half ago, and it ripped apart the whole launch complex. I mean, it created tremendous damage. I think they're going to have trouble. I mean, I think they'll get it, but I think they're going to have trouble getting a license from the government to do this again. They have this attitude of, you know, launch a rocket. If it blows up, who cares? We'll build another one, and we'll fix whatever's wrong. I've said this before on the net. If NASA was like that, and they had companies like Boeing and Lockheed building spacecraft and rockets and testing them and blowing them up on a regular basis, especially on not only, you know, maybe the first try or the second try, but the third, fourth, and then they keep blowing up, Congress would never support it. They would never get any money. I mean, you know, that would be it. Back to you, Wesley W.S.
Actually, I have another question, but I'm not sure if I'm not interrupting too much your time. Back to you.
No, that's okay. The next thing I was going to talk about was the supplies that they bought up, and one of the supplies is the ROSA, or Rollout Solar Array, that was just recently installed by two astronauts that are on board. There's seven people on board the space station right now. And I was just going to talk about that EVA, which went very well, by the way. So, yeah, go ahead, Wesley, back to you.
Okay, it was all years back in time. Year 1999, I believe. I was in a SDR program. Alexander Martins from CTC NASA put us there. I was principal investigator for Underground of Planets and Their Moons. That was a program. So that was NASA. They chose three companies. Well, my company was one of three. And then they told us, we're not going to do it, we don't have money. Which is okay. But before that, they asked me to sign the paper, so my house is security. I don't know how they call it, but anyhow, you had to put money first before you got money from them. So that was NASA. But it looks like right now, the role of NASA is unknown to me. I'm kind of lost. We have a private company leading in the research or the machinery or devices needed for travel. We have Elon Musk traveling to International Space Station and eventually offering trip to other planets, right? What is the role of NASA right now? Where is NASA right now in that situation? Who's going to build that vehicle for the moon and to exchange?
Yeah, well, it's NASA is paying a fee for the and the SLS, the Space Launch System. That's SLS being built by Lockheed and Boeing, and the spacecraft is being built by Lockheed. These are, you know, that's the standard way of that NASA has always done things for decades. But they've got this idea years ago to get involved with commercial companies. I remember Obama wanted to do that. And that's pretty much the way it started. And the reason for it is companies can develop the system. Let's say you have two companies developing a rocket system or a space station, similar to what's going to come after your space station is deorbited. You need multiple companies involved in this stuff. This way you have good competition. They'll compete against one another, or maybe you'll eventually have both, you know, two different types of rockets, which we have going on today. You have SpaceX, you have with their Falcon rocket, you're going to have Blue Origin with the New Glenn rocket. You've got many other companies, Firefly, Relativity is new. These are all new companies. NASA wouldn't be able to pay for all these new companies to do things. They're doing it pretty much on their own with the help of NASA. NASA gives them what I call seed money, but they'll give them contracts, and they're fixed price contracts now. They're not like T&M, not like time and material. You know, when I was on a job, you know, it was great to get on a time and material job because, you know, the job would seem to go on forever because the contract, you know, wouldn't be completed. But okay, well, we'll give you more time and more money, and the contract would just go on and on. No more of that. They're fixed contracts. Most of these deals are fixed where, you know, if they have a deal with SpaceX or like Boeing's doing the Starship, to go back and forth to the International Space Station. They had a fixed price of, I think it was $3 or $4 billion for that vehicle. And they said, you know, if you go over that, it's on you. So what happened is they went over it and way over it. They poured like an extra $2 or $3 billion of their own money into this thing, and they're still at it. And they still haven't made it to the International Space Station with a crew. They've made it to the space, you know, as a test without a crew, no problem. But things are changing now. If you were to take the, I think it's roughly around $25 billion for the year that NASA gets, and split that up among Boeing, you know, with the Orion spacecraft, the Space Launch System, all the existing deep space missions that they're keeping track of. There's a new X-plane, the X-59, that they're developing. All these different programs, you know, are being funded by NASA. Plus, all these private companies are now involved because NASA has, you know, given them seed money or contracts. You have much more money pouring into the whole industry. And I think that's good. Competition is very good. Back to you, Wesley. WS2N.
So I understand that the companies right now are putting mostly their own money to develop the vehicle. And eventually they think that they can convince NASA for the contract, because money that NASA provides for the vehicle is just a fraction of the total cost. So the amount of money that they think they're going to get is actually from usage of the vehicle, from the contracts they get. If they are able to be the first among the competitors, right?
Yeah, kind of like that. Look at the spacesuits. The spacesuits are being developed to walk on the moon right now. The one that they're really involved with is Axiom. There's another company too, but the Axiom is actually developing the spacesuit. When NASA did it, going back, you know, in the 60s and 70s when they developed spacesuits, that was all on NASA, you know, NASA engineers, NASA everything. The cost today would be phenomenal, you know, for each spacesuit. My guess is by the time Axiom is done, it's going to be, you know, maybe, you know, one-third of that cost, or maybe less. And the good thing is, because it's a fixed contract, if Axiom goes over, it's going to be on them to pay the extra cost to finish building these spacesuits for the people who walk on the moon. So, you know, it's a perfect example right there. Wesley.
Thank you very much for that explanation. I think that sooner or later, the private companies will try to completely eliminate NASA in it and build the vehicles, send a crew, and eventually prove that the travel to moon is not that difficult for them, and participate in the infrastructure that is needed for the people being there. But maybe I'm wrong. That's actually.
Long-term goal. They're succeeding pretty much with the space station. That first, you know, they've got private companies launching up to the space station now. All the cargo vehicles and manned vehicles that are going up and soon to be going up are private companies that NASA is now a customer for. They're paying them. You know, we'll pay you money to bring us up to the space station. The companies made money two ways. They got the seed money from NASA, maybe, and then they're actually now getting paid from NASA to bring people up to the space station. Space stations will eventually be private too, which is fine with NASA. NASA's goal is to be involved with exploration. That's why they're pouring a fortune into launching people to the moon, eventually setting up a base on the moon, one the other, you know, at least once a year. You'll have another flight going up by with Artemis. And yes, in the future, you might have SpaceX. You might have other companies that could also go to the moon. But NASA will be, leading the way with their own missions, eventually to Mars and to the other planets. Actually, there's another company, there's Relativity, that signed up with another company to actually send a lander to Mars. You know? They haven't even achieved orbit yet, but they actually have a plan on doing that. That would be an all commercial mission to actually land a vehicle on Mars by a private company. So a lot of weird things going on, but it's very good. It's almost impossible to keep up with Wesley.
And the last one, and I'm sorry for that. I wasn't doing that for many years. Interrupting you. Is it about deuterium and helium and rare metals on the moon? That's what it is about. And eventually, the money they think they're gonna get is from that. So everything is gonna be private, and the private companies are gonna pay for the infrastructure and vehicles to get that gold done.
Mining moon or asteroids, I think that's going to be private in the far distant future. I mean, NASA wants a set of habitats and infrastructure. Somebody has to do that. You can't just build a rocket. A private company can't build a rocket. Now, off to the moon they go. They need a habitat. They need power systems. NASA's developing these five kilowatt fission units that are going to be sitting on the moon, eventually, powering the base on the south pole of the moon. You know, that's their plans. NASA's paying for that. NASA's going to be heavily involved with infrastructure, private companies. They'll be happy if they can land on the moon in the beginning. They're not going to be mining anything anytime soon. But down the road, I could see that happening. But NASA will move on. They'll start exploring. They would like to explore Mars and eventually go to the outer planets. I'm talking about this. The outer planets is a launch coming up in October. I was going to talk about the Psyche mission. Psyche is going to be launched on a private rocket, SpaceX Falcon Heavy. That's one with three Falcons bolted together. On top of it, it's going to be Psyche, and it's going to go to a 140-foot diameter solid iron asteroid in the asteroid belt.
Okay. Thank you very much for all the information.
It's around 2029. It's up to by the time it gets there. But it's going to be launching in October. So, it was having problems, financial problems. NASA was getting a little tapped out of money. There was another mission that's planned, they put on hold, that would eventually go to Venus. They're holding back on that one and taking that money and pouring into this one. And they just did a review, and they were way behind. They were going to be like a year or two, from now for launching, but they've accelerated things because NASA, made some changes. So this is a very important mission for people that like science. This thing will go out to that asteroid and stay there, and visit it for many years in the future. After it gets there, I think in 2029. That's a perfect example. NASA pouring money into these flights. There'll be other ones as well. that are coming up, the Europa Clipper. That's not a private mission. That's NASA.